Well, the last significant earthquake in our region occurred in 1993 near Klamath Falls. I think the epicenter was actually in the Mountain Lakes Wilderness. I remember feeling the earth shake my house here in Ashland. And in fact, the quake was felt throughout the region from Eugene to Redding. But in the basin itself, there were two earthquake-related fatalities, and both the county courthouse and library, if memory serves, in downtown Klamath Falls sustained significant damage. But those quakes, there were actually two of them in that incident, were 6.0 and 5.9 on the Richter scale. But that's small compared to what geologists expect from a Cascadia subduction zone quake, which could reach 9 or higher on the Richter scale. Klamath Falls native Steve Eberline and Lydia Ledgerwood Eberline were living in Sri Lanka when a tsunami from the Indian Ocean quake of 2004 devastated that island and killed over 200,000 people in that part of Southeast Asia. The lack of preparedness they witnessed upon their return to Oregon inspired them to start a business called Tipping Point Resilience to help people and organizations get ready for earthquakes like the big one expected from the Cascadia subduction zone. They're hosting a free session in Klamath Falls Saturday, and they join us this morning to talk about it. Good morning, Steve and Lydia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us this morning. So you both were in Sri Lanka in 2004. A few of us have experienced an earthquake of the magnitude that's predicted for the Cascadia subduction zone, but you actually did experience that one. Can you tell us about the experience?
Sure. So we didn't actually experience the earthquake. The earthquake took place in Indonesia. So what we experienced was the resulting tsunami, which devastated multiple countries in the area, and we happened to be in Sri Lanka at the time. So we didn't feel the shaking, which is fortunate, I think, because there was enough damage done by the tsunami itself.
And so what, in terms of preparedness, what did you find in the aftermath of that tsunami?
So one thing that was completely lacking in Sri Lanka, and I think a number of countries, was adequate warning. So it took about 2.5 hours for the tsunami to actually travel from Indonesia to reach Sri Lanka, which is ample time to get people off the beaches, to clear out coastal hotels, and there was no warning whatsoever. So when you talk about preparedness, just not having enough preparedness to get people out of harm's way, that was really striking when I learned how long it took for that tsunami to actually reach us. And these sorts of events only happen once every 100, 200, 300 years. So one of the difficulties is that very few places are prepared for something that only happens once every so many generations. And it just so happens that the Pacific Northwest finds itself in exactly that situation right now.
And so when you came back to Oregon, you found us all living in blissful ignorance?
Well, Lydia, tell them about our trip down the coast coming back from Sri Lanka.
Right. So we came home. We came home to Oregon. We moved to Portland. And shortly thereafter, we took a trip down the coast because it had been quite some time since we'd seen our own home state coast. And it was incredibly unnerving for me because everywhere were signs about tsunamis, tsunami evacuation routes, in the hotel rooms, on the roads, which I think were a direct result of what happened in 2004 in the Indian Ocean. It was unnerving, though, because I was completely unaware, as many, many Pacific Northwesterners were and remain, of this enormous threat that sort of is sleeping in our region.
And it's kind of ironic being both from Klamath Falls, Oregon, because Lydia and I were both living in Klamath Falls for the 1993 earthquakes. Mm-hmm. And I was a sophomore in high school in a geology class or a social studies class when our teacher said, quoting him directly, "There never have been and there never will be earthquakes in Oregon." And, of course, the very next day we did have that 6-point earthquake in Klamath Falls. But the thing that we didn't have in 1993 yet was a good backbone of science. It's really the good work of Dr. Chris Goldfinger and Oregon State University and other paleoseismologists who tracked all those past earthquakes to give us a clear picture of how present the danger is right now. We didn't know that in 1993, though.
Right.
We're talking with Steve Eberlein and Lydia Ledgerwood Eberlein. Their company is called Tipping Point Resilience. They're giving a workshop on earthquake preparedness this Saturday in Klamath Falls. So we always hear people talking about worst-case scenarios, and there is growing awareness of the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. But what predictable damage could come from such an earthquake?
So when you look at the Pacific Northwest with the Cascadia subduction zone, we'd be worried about one of two scenarios. Essentially, we're worried about both 8-point magnitude earthquakes and 9-point magnitude earthquakes. And the essential difference between 8-point and 9-point is how much of the fault line ruptures. And what 8-point and 9-point magnitudes have in common is that both of those types of earthquakes do impact southern Oregon. And the impact would include a tsunami, which would impact just the coast. We're not as worried in Klamath Falls about tsunamis. It would never reach this far. But what we would expect throughout the state is essentially an infrastructural breakdown, that the roads you drove today, the phone that you made a call on, the electricity, the water that came from your tap, the toilet that flushed, all those things can become under threat from the shaking event. And we rely on those. And when we don't have the amenities that we rely on a daily basis, we can have secondary disasters that come from that lack of what allows us to be civilized daily human beings.
So when you talk with people about earthquake preparedness and you describe situations like that that you just described this morning, what barriers do you find when you talk to people? Is it sort of the thousand mile stare, oh, it's never going to happen in my lifetime kind of thing?
So, yes, there are a couple of cultural things that are in our way still. For one, not many people have experience with a large disaster, particularly if you're living in the Pacific Northwest. It's not like Texas, which is used to big floods. It's not like Missouri, which is used to big tornadoes. We just don't have a lot of disaster experience. And when you don't have disaster experience, you don't have a lot of stories to tell, right? And it's the stories that we tell each other about past disasters that give credence to today's preparedness. Mm-hmm. So we just don't have that background of stories. And secondly, we basically transmit culture, no matter where you go in the world, through conversations and through the visible acts of other people around us. I don't think you see people preparing. I don't think you hear people talking about preparedness and earthquakes at the kitchen table. And so introducing a big topic that makes people really uncomfortable into Pacific Northwest culture is the challenge that Tipping Point Resilience was created to address.
And John, I think there's a wide spectrum. So you described the thousand-mile stare. There's that, but there are people who don't believe that it's going to happen at all. We've heard the phrase fear-mongering constantly since we started this work. And then we also have people within our friends and family group who have literally said, well, everybody's going to die anyway, so why bother getting ready? So we have this wide spectrum of it's nothing to it's going to be the apocalypse. And what's good about Steve's presentation, he's calibrated it over hundreds of presentations to get it to the sweet spot where it's enough science and it's enough. There's enough evidence to convince the naysayers, but then there's also enough like, hey, getting ready makes this less apocalyptic. And I wouldn't describe it as apocalyptic in the first place, but it sort of neutralizes that spectrum, that wide spectrum of how people respond to this, because it's a fear-based response. This is a lot of information. It's new to a lot of people, and it can be very frightening. And that's what's great about the preparedness message, is that it sort of helps to assuage those fears, put a little bit more control into people's everyday lives to get ready for something this big.
So some of our listeners, certainly especially in Northern California, have recent experience of terrible natural disasters in the form of catastrophic wildfire. Yeah. Are you finding that with the increased awareness of wildfires and the fact that more people certainly are aware of how to prepare for evacuations is making your message a little bit clearer to them?
Yeah, I'm finding that a lot more people have kits in their cars than when we first came back to the Pacific Northwest. And having that go kit in your car, I think that that is a response to ever-present wildfire risk. And so the basic understanding of preparedness, I do think it is improving. I do think that wildfires have drawn more people to take action. And when we look at earthquake preparedness, we talk about this as the PhD level of preparedness, because earthquakes give no notice, and you never know where you're going to be during that earthquake. So one of the messages that we tout is be ready at home, be ready in your car, be ready at work, because those are the three places that you're most likely to experience an earthquake, and it will also get you ready for the other intervening disasters that are going to happen between now and the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, be it a power outage, be it a winter storm, be it a wildfire.
We're talking with Steve Eberlein and Lydia Ledgerwood Eberlein of Tipping Point Resilience. They're giving a workshop this weekend on earthquake preparedness Saturday in Klamath Falls. Now, Steve and Lydia, we hear the word resilience used a lot now. I've noticed that in some of your material as well. That word's got the quality of some other words you hear, like sustainability. Everybody seems to have a vague idea of what it means, but there's really no hard and fast definition. So when you use the word resilience, what does that mean to you?
So resilience is sort of a wider umbrella concept to preparedness. Preparedness fits inside of resilience, and preparedness is the more tangible concept inside of resilience. So preparedness is having the stuff you need, having a family plan specific to certain kinds of disasters. Resilience is a concept of if a community is resilient, they will be able to absorb the impact of a negative event in their community better and recover faster than a less resilient community. So it includes all these big concepts, like if you are, the one that keeps coming up a lot with preparedness is if you are not, if you don't have enough food in the first place, how can you store 2 weeks worth for an emergency? That's the most obvious one that comes up over and over again. And so resilient communities are communities that have reliable and good shelter for people, education so that they can receive messages like the ones we put out and the ones that the Oregon Emergency Management Office put out about how to get ready. It's about being healthy in the first place so that when a disaster hits, you're not already vulnerable. So resilience is this sort of wide overarching concept, which is what the ultimate goal is. If a community is resilient, we can absorb the impact of something big and recover faster. And that's the ultimate goal of any kind of preparedness. So whether it's wildfire, whether it's earthquake, whether it's economic downturn, we want our communities to be resilient so they can recover faster.
Go ahead.
Oh, I might just add one more thing. So I look at resilience as a combination of mitigation and preparedness. So mitigation efforts, those are taken on by the state when it comes to how ready our bridges are, to how ready is the critical energy infrastructure hub on the Willamette River, mm-hmm. which holds 90% of Oregon's fuel. That stuff is too big for you and me to take care of. So that's a mitigation effort that needs to be taken on by the state. But when you look at the state, they can't put food in your pantry. They can't fill up your emergency water containers. That's preparedness. That's your and my responsibility. But when you're prepared and the state is undertaking mitigation efforts, that lays the groundwork for a more resilient Oregon.
You know, one thing that occurred to me as we were talking about community resilience is that, you know, there's a trend in American society of more and more people living alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been well documented that, you know, there are a lot of institutions that have traditionally provided a sense of community and support for people who are in need. You know, I'm thinking of clubs and then fraternal organizations like the Elks or the Odd Fellows and of course, churches. And they're all seeing declining numbers if you look at the statistics nationwide. How do you work at building community resilience, you know, when our society seems so alienated?
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's actually one of the biggest challenges to, if we just come down to the more specific concept of preparedness, Your family plan has to include community members. A perfect example of that is that Steve and I live, and our family live on the east side of the river. Our kids go to school on the west side. It's really overwhelming to think what would happen if the earthquake hit while we were separated, which means we have to bring in a wider community. You know, which of our friends and family work across the river? Who do we know at school who could take them? And you have to start having this conversation with this uncomfortable conversation with people outside of your immediate sphere. And as you said, we're encouraged to be dependent upon ourselves only. We can get anything we want over the internet. We can travel alone to work and travel home without speaking to anybody except the people we have to at work. So it's definitely an obstacle. But the way we like to look at it is that preparedness is a way to sort of recreate those connections because they're going to become vital post-disaster. That we will be forced to rely upon each other in a way we haven't had to as a culture in a really long time post-disaster.
I want to bring in a comment here from a listener of ours, Carter in Wolf Creek, who just phoned this in. He's not on the phone with us, but he offered that Native people have stories, but many of those stories have been destroyed because, you know, our culture has come to predominate. And I was thinking of that as I read this comment from Carter of an example that Steve, you use in your TED Talk of a tribe in that Sri Lanka incident. Can you relate that to us?
Oh, this is, I love that I had an opportunity to bring this up because I think it's magical, the power of oral history. And you're right, we have lost oral history as a means of transmitting information. So the story of the tribe, first of all, is in North Sentinel Island, which was very near to the epicenter of the 2004 9.1 earthquake. It's an endangered tribe. The North Sentinelese, they have no contact with outside world. No one even knows what language they speak. And it was widely feared that after this major earthquake tsunami, that they were likely rendered extinct. They started flying Indian helicopters over the island to check upon them. And they found that every expected member did emerge from the jungles. And to boot, they threw spears at the helicopters to let them know just how well they were. And of course, we don't know what or how they knew about the tsunami risk, but whatever they knew, it was obviously transmitted through oral history, and they're hearing important information from people that they know, love, and trust. So what I learned from that anecdote is that we have tons of knowledge, right? In the West, we have tons of knowledge. Turn on your radio, and you get more knowledge, but you're not convinced to put knowledge into practice necessarily just by listening to the radio or reading the newspaper. It's when you see someone that you know, love, and trust change their behavior in a way that you know makes sense, that you are influenced to change your own behavior. That's the magic that oral history accomplishes that we are kind of missing, kind of getting back to your former, the point you made formerly about just being a more disconnected community. So one of the empowering things, though, about the presentation is we want you to take the information, we want you to put it into practice, and we want you to show other people what you're doing, because that's our own way of creating new oral history.
And to your original point, John, there are tribes in Oregon, particularly along the coast, who have the last earthquake event or the subduction event in their oral history. It's all down the coast, and in our own area, the Klamath tribe, their origin story is tied up with the explosion of Mount Mazama, which is both seismic and volcanic activity. So it exists in the Pacific Northwest as well. We just need to pay attention to it as a Western culture, as a society that colonized and sort of, or not sort of, but very, very much it eliminated those oral histories in terms of their import to the land we live on. And I think that that's such an important point that Steve has always brought up in his presentation, is that the tribes know, they have known, and they've been passing it down.
Steve Eberlein and Lydia Ledgerwood Eberlein are Tipping Point Resilience. They live in Klamath Falls. They're doing a preparedness workshop this weekend in Klamath Falls. And I don't intend to squeeze your entire presentation into the remaining 2.5 minutes that we have. But if you could name 2 or 3 top actions that somebody could take at home to prepare for the big one, the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, and as you offered earlier, that preparedness also translates to other natural disasters. But what 2 or 3 things could people do at home that would get them on their way to being prepared?
The place I would start is start with a family reunification plan. This is something that's free, it is equitable, it is within the reach of everyone who has the will to sit down and have a hard conversation. Family reunification means knowing who in your family is going to be responsible for gathering the most vulnerable people in your family, be it your aging parents or your children, and knowing where you're going to reunite during a time of uncertainty, how you're going to reunite at home or having an alternative spot to reunite should your home not be safe after a disaster, and actually having a third reunification spot as well in case plan A and plan B don't pan out. That conversation, it kind of creates a chandelier where you can place other preparedness actions, such as building your emergency water supply, such as having a talk with your doctor about stockpiling your medication, such as making sure that you've got the right tools and implements on hand during a time when utilities and services are going to be unreliable or unavailable.
And then how about the workplace, very quickly?
In the workplace, so when you go to work, you don't think that you're going to show up at work on Tuesday and then leave on Thursday. But that just might be the case, especially during a large earthquake. So having readiness at the workplace, having the things that you need to be comfortable and to survive at work for several days. And this is something that every workplace should be pushing its employees to do, because this is the backbone of business continuity.
I want to jump in here, Steve, because we're running out of time.
Sure.
Briefly tell us where and when your workshop is in Klamath Falls this weekend.
Lydia, take it.
We'll be at the Ross Ragland Theater on Saturday night at 7 p.m., and we would love to see as many people, as many Jefferson listeners as possible there, because the word is spreading in Southern Oregon, and we're really happy about that.
Steve and Lydia, thanks so much for joining us on today's Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.